Hey, this is Adam Kahanowitz from the Vegan News on vegan.fm. I recently had the honor of interviewing a prominent figure in animal rights theory, whom will be introduced in a moment. Before I start, I've just got to point out the interview suffers a very cheap microphone on my part, which will make this interview appear as if done in a bathroom or some sort of small box. So, my apologies for this. But I hope I can convince anyone to hear this interview. I don't care if you're a vegan, an omnivore, no matter who you are, as long as you're not from New Jersey, you'll find this talk to change the way you think about animals. Finally, the links and resources mentioned in this interview will be available in this interview's notes. Enjoy. As some of my regular readers and viewers have surely noticed, I've been covering a topic of animal rights theory called the abolitionist approach. In popular culture, the term animal rights group has been tied to individuals using displays of sexism to advertise vegetarian diets, groups who legislate for better confinement and slaughterhouse practices, and even movements who use violent fear tactics against animal research labs. However, a particular theory developed by Gary Francione called the abolitionist approach presents a very different method. According to the website abolitionistapproach.com, the approach requires the abolition of animal exploitation and rejects regulation thereof. It is based only on animal sentience and no other cognitive characteristic and regards veganism as the moral baseline of the animal rights position. Professor Gary L. Francione is a distinguished professor of law and Nicholas D.B. Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law, Newark. While his abolitionist approach is nothing new, its relevance to our current system of animal exploitation has recently been gaining increased presence with the advent of more grassroots internet communication and a need to address the modern trend of ethically slaughtered, humanely raised, and cage-free animal products. So I'm so happy to have Professor Francione for this interview to once again challenge the way that we approach animal rights. Welcome, Gary.
Hi. Thank you very much, Adam. It's nice to be with you.
So let's begin with a general question. Some of my animal-loving readers are looking back on what has been an eventful decade for animal welfare, what with Proposition 2 in California. Laws are gradually prohibiting the use of battery cages. They're demanding larger gestation crates for sows and so on. Do you believe the animal rights movement is moving in the right direction?
Are you including the things you've just described as part of the animal rights movement?
Yeah, to be clear.
Okay, then I understand your question.
We would have to start with.
The answer is no. The answer is no. I think that stuff is all nonsense. First of all, I don't think that the past decade has been any more important in terms of animal welfare regulation than the decades before that. This stuff's been going on. I mean, I got involved with the movement in the early 1980s. And, the movement in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s in the United States was was focusing on, these sorts of, not exactly these sorts of things, but they were, focusing on things like the Humane Slaughter Act and the Federal Animal Welfare Act and, various anti-cruelty laws and things like that. So this stuff's been going on forever. And I don't think the last decade is any more momentous than the decades before that. Indeed, in certain ways, probably less momentous. But I don't think that animal welfare is the way to go. And I don't think, I think that that regulating animal exploitation is a dead end. It can't work. I mean, first of all, the regulation of animal exploitation assumes that we can. That it's all right for us to use animals as long as we treat them in a particular way. And I think I challenge that. I don't think we can justify animal use, however, quote, humane, unquote, it is. I just don't think it's – I don't think we can do that, number one. I mean, I think that there's a serious moral problem with doing that. But secondly, I don't think it works, and there's no empirical proof that it works. I mean, this is the problem. I mean, animals are chattel property. They have an economic value. I don't think that the animal welfare measures that you've just mentioned are particularly momentous, and I don't regard them as consistent with the animal rights position, at least as I understand it. Let me say, first of all, the sorts of things that we are seeing now, the sorts of welfare reforms that we're seeing now, they're nothing new, Adam. We've been seeing these sorts of things, throughout the 20th century. I mean, indeed, one can point to various periods of time where we've actually had what is arguably more important welfare reform, such as the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958, the Federal Animal Welfare Act, which was originally passed in 1966. So, I mean, there have been all sorts of animal welfare measures. As a matter of fact, we've had animal welfare for the better part of 200 years. We're using more animals now in more horrendous ways than we ever have in human history. I mean, the with the advent of the internet and all of these various social networking things, the welfare reforms that are being promoted by these various organizations get a lot more play now, but there's really nothing about them that is in any way special or more progressive or anything else. But more importantly, I think we have to sort of focus on the fact that the animal welfare reform, the welfarist approach really sort of misses the point in a couple of respects. First of all, there's the issue about whether we can justify animal use, however humane it is or isn't, is a different question. I mean, the question is, can we justify animal use? And it is my position that we can't. It is a fundamental premise of the welfarist position that animal use per se is not morally objectionable. It's how we treat them. And I want to go back to that in a second, because that's a very, very important point that your listeners need to understand.
Okay.
The second point is whether or not welfare reform works, and as a practical matter, and the answer is it doesn't. Animals are property, and what I've been arguing in my work now for the better part of a couple of decades is that because animals are property, the level of welfare that the level of welfare that we will provide for them will be linked to that level that is necessary to exploit them in an economically efficient way. That is, we will protect their interests to the extent that we get an economic benefit from doing so. We're not going to protect their interests in a way in which we're spending more money than we're getting back, because to do so would be economically inefficient, and in a world of free trade would place us in a situation of competitive disadvantage. So animal welfare reform really doesn't work. I mean, it just doesn't work, and there's no empirical proof that it does. There's no empirical proof that it has ever led to the abolition of any form of institutionalized exploitation. So the bottom line is animal welfare doesn't work as a practical matter. All it's going – what it really is going to do, Adam, is animal welfare consists of a set of rules – for rational property use. If all property owners were rational, we wouldn't even need animal welfare laws, because they would not be acting in an inefficient way. Part of the problem is animal property is different from other forms of property, because unlike your car or your iPod or whatever, animal property is sentient. It has interests, it has preferences, wants, or desires. So it's a different form of property. And because it is a different form of property, property owners are sometimes, they don't have the full information they need to understand how to exploit their property in a most efficient manner.
Mm-hmm.
So what animal welfare laws do basically is to ensure that the owners of animal property exploit that property in an economically efficient way, which is another way of saying that animal welfare regulation is very rarely, if ever, going to provide a level of protection that goes beyond what is necessary in order to exploit the animal efficiently, i.e., we're not going to spend more money in protecting them than we're going to get back as an economic matter. But I want to go back to my first point about the philosophical issue, because lots of times people think, well, philosophical issues are useless because who cares about philosophy? And the answer is we all ought to care about philosophy, because it is theory that informs our actions. If we don't have a theory, we don't really know what actions we're going to take or we should take.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go back to that point, because you see, if you look at the history of animal welfare, if you look to 19th century England, for example, what you see is you see people like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill saying, you know, well, look, you know, we've made a big mistake by not including animals in the moral community. However, Bentham and Mill, who opposed slavery, did not oppose the ownership and use of animals. They opposed the harsh treatment of animals. They thought we ought to treat animals better. Mm-hmm. They didn't oppose our using animals because they believed that although animals could suffer, they were sentient, so they were like us in one sense. They were unlike us in the sense that they did not have an interest in their lives. A cow doesn't care that we kill her and eat her. She only cares about how we treat her and while she's alive and how we kill her. She doesn't really care that we use her. She cares how we use her. She does not have an interest in her life the way you have an interest in your life. She doesn't have a sense of the future the way you have a sense of the future. This is the view that the 19th century utilitarians have. Now, you can say, well, yes, but that was the 19th century, and we've progressed, and we understand a lot more now. I would point you then to Peter Singer, because his views are exactly the same.
Okay, now Peter that Singer, he's the author of Animal Liberation.
Yes,
he's been considered the father of the animal rights movement.
Yes.
To which you object.
Yes, indeed, because I don't think, I mean, Peter quite explicitly rejects the concept of rights.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, for your listeners, not to bore them with philosophy, but a utilitarian basically says what is right or wrong is dependent on the consequences. Somebody who believes in rights says that there are certain instances in which you can't balance consequences. So even if it would be consequentially beneficial for you to use me in a biomedical experiment to find a cure for cancer, we say I have a right not to be used in that situation because my interest in my life is protected even if it would be consequentially beneficial for you to exploit me. So
okay.
Peter Singer, like Jeremy Bentham, like John Stuart Mill, is a utilitarian. He does not believe in rights. So calling him the father of the animal rights movement is right off the bat a misdescription. But if you look at Peter Singer's theory, he basically takes the same position Bentham took. He does not think that animals, with the exception of animals like the non-human great apes, he does not believe that they have an interest in their lives. He does not believe that they care about how we use them. They care about, they don't care that we use them. They care about how we use them. They don't care if we exploit them. They just want to be exploited in a humane way. They want to suffer as little as possible. They want to be killed in as painless a method, using as painless a method as possible. But they don't, you know, they don't care. They live in an eternal present. They don't have a sense of the future, and they don't really care about the fact that they're being used. They just care about how they're being used. That's basically Peter Singer's view. And so the welfarist position is it which reflect. Now, I'm not saying all of your listeners or readers who consider themselves to be adherents of animal welfare think in these terms, but the bottom line is if they're subscribing to the theory of animal welfare, whether they realize it or not, they are subscribing to the philosophical view that the killing, the use and killing per se of animals does not raise a moral problem. It is the treatment of animals that raises the moral problem. So that's why I think the welfare position really doesn't work. I don't think you can justify that position that animals don't have an interest in their lives because they don't have minds like ours. I mean, I accept that because we are animals that use symbolic communication language, the sense of self-awareness I have and that I assume you have, although I don't have access to your mind, so I don't know exactly what you think, but I assume you think the way I think. But the sense of self-awareness that I have, that you probably have and that all normal humans have, is very much dependent on this thing called language, the symbolic communication that we have called language. And I'm sure that non-human animals don't have the same sort of self-awareness that you and I have and that other humans have who use language. On the other hand, I also don't have any doubt that animals are self-aware. They're just self-aware in a different sort of way. And I think it's speciesist to say that human self-awareness is somehow morally privileged and non-human self-awareness is somehow inferior. But that is the position that forms the foundation of animal welfare. And that is the position that allows the animal welfare advocate to say, well, you know, the real problem is how we treat them, not that we use them. And so if we decide we want to, you know, I mean, it's all right for us to use animals as long as they have a reasonably pleasant life, and as long as they have a relatively painless death, then there's nothing wrong with our use of animals. And so that's the basic philosophical position which underlies the animal welfare position, which is expressed explicitly by the people who formulated that theory and by the people who continue to promote that theory, like Peter Singer. But I also think that these folks really don't understand a lot about the world of economics, and they don't understand the fact that that even if that philosophical proposition were true, it would be very, very difficult to get a level of protection for animals, a level of welfare protection that was very, very high, or was very high at all, because it costs money to protect animal interests, and the more money you spend on protecting animal interests, if you can't recoup that money, then that's an opportunity cost that is going to be imposed on you, and in a world of free trade, it's going to make it impossible for you to be competitive, and so therefore you're not going to provide that level of protection. You simply can't.
To recap here, first beginning with my question, I asked you basically how is the animal rights movement doing, but I was describing the movement to make gestation crates larger, get rid of cages, and so what you're saying is, wait a minute, why are we even calling that the animal rights movement? Is that correct?
Exactly. And let's focus on gestation crates or veal crates for a second. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Gestation crates and veal crates are basically economically inefficient ways of raising animals. And so what the animal welfare movement is doing is focusing on practices that are themselves being questioned by the industry. And they're basically going to be phased out by the industry in any event. And so they focus and they build campaigns around these inefficient mechanisms. So let's, you know, I mean there's a lot of literature out there that gestation crates are economically inefficient and that alternatives like electronic sow feeding, for example, is a much better way of raising of dealing with gestation, because there's a higher sow productivity. The animals suffer fewer diseases, fewer broken bones. They're more productive as sows, and the producer makes more money. Same thing with veal crates. You know, animals that are raised in veal crates suffer a lot of stress-related illnesses that result in high veterinary costs. Putting them in intensive but less intensive situations where they're with a couple of other calves because they're social animals will permit them to have a much better, a much lower rate of disease, and that will reduce veterinary costs, and so it will be better for the producer. So that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the level of animal welfare is linked to these economic considerations. What the animal welfare groups do basically is they look for practices which are economically inefficient, and then they go after those practices, you know, where industry is already beginning to question the utility of these particular mechanisms. They go after these practices, and then when the practices are abandoned because it's economically a good thing for the producers to do, the welfare reformers claim victory. And so I think, you know, I mean, another example of this is the campaign going on right now with PETA. PETA's trying to get these fast food places to adopt controlled atmosphere killing or stunning of poultry rather than electrical stunning. There's a lot of literature out there that indicates that if you were starting a poultry slaughtering operation today, you would be crazy to do anything else but controlled atmosphere killing or stunning, because electrical stunning is much more expensive, results in more worker injuries, greater carcass damage. It's much more economically efficient to do controlled atmosphere killing or controlled atmosphere stunning. And so, you know, remember, intensive agriculture, Adam, is something that developed largely in the 1950s. And so the economic consequences, the inefficiencies, the problems with intensive agriculture, the economic problems are only becoming apparent now. They're not in the 1950s. The thinking was, well, you know, if you can pack a zillion animals in a cage, well, then, you know, if you can make a dollar off of one and you can put 100 in a cage, you'll make $100. And there was never any thought that these were a different form of property. They're sentient. They suffer stress. They suffer stress-related illnesses and things like that. And so that you really can't not factor in the notion that these are sentient beings. And if you don't do that, then you're going to suffer certain economic consequences. And that the economic consequences are only becoming apparent now. They weren't really, the thinking in the 1950s, nobody was thinking in the 1950s and the 1960s that animals were going to suffer stress-related illnesses because nobody really recognized that animals suffered stress in any serious way. Now the industry recognizes that some of the things that the industry has been doing to animals is really problematic. Because it results in sicker animals, and sicker animals result in higher veterinary costs and result in more broken bones and more carcass damage and more whatever, and reduces profitability. So in a sense, a lot of the things that these animal welfare people are promoting are things that industry would probably adopt anyway. In fact, there's a sort of a complicated dance that goes on, because by focusing attention on, it's sort of these organizations have a sort of an almost symbiotic relationship with industry, because, they raise these issues, and then industry says, oh no, we're not gonna give in, even though industry almost has to do that, whether they care or not about losing the particular battle, because they almost always have to put up some sort of opposition. Because if they don't, then they invite challenges that might matter to them in the future. So they always put up token resistance. And then eventually, because it's economically efficient, they will give in to some sort of regulation because that's a good thing for them to do. And then they get to go to the public and say, we're humane. We care about, the humane treatment of animals, so buy our animal products. And the animal welfare groups get to go to the public and say, see what we did. We forced industry to make changes. Give us donations. So it's really sort of a very, very sort of symbiotic dance that these animal, there's a real relationship that these animal welfare groups have with industry. And, it's orchestrated. You can see it repeated again and again and again and again and again. So I don't think these things are working. As a matter of fact, I really think that what they amount to in the medieval period, the Catholic Church used to sell indulgences. So, if you wanted to go out and be a bad person, you could do so. You could just go to the church, give them money, and they would sell you an indulgence, and you would get into heaven. And what's happening now is the animal welfare groups are doing the same things, because most of the people who are contributing to these groups are people who eat animal products or wear animal products or otherwise consume animal products. And what these organizations are doing is saying, look, we understand you're concerned about animal suffering. We understand that you're concerned about issues of animal ethics. But go ahead and continue to eat your ice cream and your cheese pizza or your organic turkey burgers or whatever you want to do, and give us a donation and we'll make it better for you. So in a sense, these organizations are like selling indulgences, and that's the way I see it, really.
Now, let's recap here. The abolitionist approach—it's not simply just a different way of thinking about animal rights. I mean, there's a fundamental disagreement here, and it's like what talking about with property.
Absolutely.
You use the example of like iPods and things that we have as property. Now, I think there's somebody out there who's probably saying right now, now wait a minute, if animals are property, we take care of our property, don't we? And I recall a lady who had a horse carriage business, and there were some accusations that I think this was done by Friends of Animals. They were pushing for the abolition of horse carriages, and she simply replied, "Wait a minute, these horses are my property. Why would I treat them badly? They're my property. I want these accusations must be bogus. It would be against my interest to treat them badly." What do you think about that?
Well, but again, farmers, the intensive agriculture people say the same thing. They say, look, these cows are very, very valuable pieces of property for me. Why would I treat them badly? As a matter of fact, there are legal cases in which people have challenged various practices and where the courts have said, well, we have to interpret a statute that prohibits the infliction of unnecessary suffering. Now, surely no rational property owner would inflict more suffering than is necessary, because that would be like somebody just taking a hammer and going out and, bashing their car in for no reason. Why would anybody do that? And so when she says these horses are my property and I'm going to take care of my property, what she means is I'm going to provide the level of protection to these animals that is consistent with my maximizing the economic return I'm getting from them. So, you know, I will have them. I mean, look, obviously horses. Are you talking about like the carriage trade in New York? Or
right, this would
like
be
that?
Like in a yeah. city, yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I mean, I really believe that that's a horrible situation. When you see these poor horses, I was in New York yesterday, and when you see these poor horses, you know, trudging around Midtown Manhattan or the Upper West Side or whatever, it's just dreadful. Now, do they feed the horses? Sure they do. Do they provide veterinary care to the horses? Sure they do. They have to, because these horses are expensive and they're investments that they have. And just like you have to take your car in and have it serviced, you know, every couple of months because your car is an expensive piece of property, you know, they're going to provide whatever they have to provide to these horses to keep their horses up there and running, just like you're going to provide the level of protection to your car, the level of care to your car that you have to provide to keep your car running. But just as it would be crazy, you know, let's assume that you have a car that and your car is worth $1,000. And you know, your car is giving you some trouble. You take it to the mechanic, and the mechanic says, Adam, you've got a problem with your car. It's going to cost you $5,000 for me to fix it. Well, you're not going to pay the $5,000 to have the car fixed, unless the car like has some sort of sentimental value to you. You know, your grandmother gave it to you, and she's passed on now, and you know, you really want to keep the car. So unless you have some sort of, you know, emotional attachment to that car, you're not going to spend the $5,000, because you would be irrational. It would be irrational to spend $5,000 on something that's worth $1,000. Similarly, we're going to provide the level of welfare protection to those horses, the bare minimum level that we need to provide in order to keep those horses up and walking on those streets of Manhattan or Philadelphia or wherever else, or, you know, New Orleans or wherever else they walk around. And so you know, that's the thing that we've got to keep in mind, that because they're property, the economic considerations that go into how we're going to treat them really no different from the economic considerations that go into how you're going to, you know, decisions you're going to make about your car. And as I say, you're not going to spend $5,000 to protect a $1,000 car unless you have an emotional attachment to it. Now, interestingly, many of us live with companion animals. I have four rescue dogs. I don't consider them my property. I consider them to be refugees that, you know, live with Anna and me. They would be dead if we didn't take them in. They are my property, but I don't regard them as my property. They have no market value. They are worth nothing in terms of market value, okay? Or they're worth very little in terms of market value. But I end up spending more money on their veterinary care than their economic value is. But that is because I have an emotional attachment to them and regard them as a member of my family. But if I was acting completely rationally, I would not spend that money on them. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I can just hear somebody saying now that, I've got an aunt, she has a dairy farm, and she loves those animals, she gives them names, you know, that's okay, right? We can drink milk from that farm. Would that be justifiable? What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, there. First of all, you know, the myth of the you know, the person who's – in order for a cow to give milk, the cow's got to be pregnant. So where do the calves go?
Yeah.
Where do the calves go?
Yeah, there you go.
Number one. You know, number two, what happens when that cow, you know, gets old? You know, there's this myth out there that people have these cows that sort of like live like dogs and cats in their houses and stuff like that. And that's just nonsense. There's no such thing. I mean, I have been on organic farms. I have been small little, you know, collectives and cooperatives and things like that. And are the animals treated better than they are in these large agribusiness operations? And the answer is, yeah, I guess. But there's still an enormous amount of suffering and death that go on, and there's still a lot of exploitation. And you can't really sort of analogize it to, you know, how those of us who really love our dogs and cats treat our dogs and cats. And having said that, let me make one thing clear to your listeners, which may shock them, but, you know, I might as well get this out because some of your people are going to say, yeah, but the implications of what he's saying saying is X, Y, and Z, and let me get X, Y, and Z on the table.
Okay.
You will not in your life meet somebody who loves dogs more than I loved. I love dogs. I just love my dog. I love living with dogs.
Mm-hmm.
If there were two dogs left on the planet and it was up to me as to whether or not they were going to, you know, continue to breed so that we could have pets,
mm-hmm.
the answer is absolutely not. We shouldn't be bringing domesticated animals into existence in the first place. That's the problem. Domestication is itself a form of violence. We can't justify it. We never should have domesticated animals, but in any event, we should stop it now. We should take care of the ones we have. We should stop bringing domesticated animals into existence, and that means dogs and cats. You know, we should take care of the ones we have here, but no more. We shouldn't be breeding. The idea that we are breeding another dog or another cat is, to my mind, morally indefensible and shocking.
Okay, so companion animals like cats and dogs, etc., Do you believe that they belong to a kind of like a special category that is outside of the realm of animals like cows and goats? And
you mean dogs and
mm-hmm,
cats?
Mm-hmm. And
only insofar as certain societies like ours fetishize them. I mean, you know, I mean, what I find bizarre is that, you know, you have people that love dogs, you know, they have dogs and cats and they just love them. And, you know, when they die, people grieve for like months, sometimes years. But these people, the same people who regard their dogs and cats as members of their family, stick forks into other animals that are no different. I mean, there's really no difference between, you know, a cow and a dog, except, you know, the cow is larger. I guess there are some dogs that are pretty big, but, you know, cows are larger, but there's really no difference. There's no difference between a pig and a dog, except actually the pigs are probably smarter than most dogs. I mean, pigs are enormously smart animals. And so to the extent that intelligence matters to you, pigs are a lot smarter than dogs. But you know, I think we fetishize dogs and cats. You know, I remember there was a campaign. I don't know whether it's something that people in your generation would resonate with you, but because it was probably about 10 – I don't know. It was about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, where a number of groups in this country were focused on the fact that Koreans ate dogs. Are you familiar
yeah.
with that campaign? Okay, well, then you are. Yeah. All right, so the Korean dog campaign. And I used to get all these mailings all the time about, you know, these horrible Koreans eating their dogs.
Right, right.
And I remember thinking how, like, incredibly racist it was because, you know, this stuff is being sent out by, you know, the same people – you know, who eat animals, but they don't eat dogs and cats, you know, and they think that, you know, the Koreans are somehow morally, you know, moral eunuchs because they eat dogs. Now, I don't think the Koreans should be eating dogs, but I don't think we should be eating cows or pigs or chickens or fish.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, there's really no difference, and it's just easier to raise money by, you know, by sending around mailing showing people who don't look like us or, you know, showing age, you know, basically let's go after the Asians. Is really what those, you know, I thought that campaign was incredibly offensive. I found that campaign as a matter of I thought it was just horrible. And I remember raising this with animal people, got all upset with me. You know, people got all upset with me, and they said, you know, how can you oppose this campaign? And I said, because I don't see the difference between eating dogs and eating cows and pigs. I mean, I just really don't see the difference. The only difference is it's Koreans, you know, and or Chinese or whatever, whoever you go, you know, whoever the group, you know. Look, we manufacture evil people. I mean, you know, it's – if you look at – there's been a very interesting discussion that's been going on. There's a blog. It's called, I think it's called My Face is on Fire. The woman who runs the blog, who's an abolitionist animal rights type, she wrote a really interesting essay a couple days ago in which she criticized in a way that I regard as both professional, competent, and you know, I mean, she did a really fine little essay.
Mm.
And it generated an enormous response. There are probably about 100 comments that have been lodged, and I've been participating in the discussion as well, which I generally don't do on these blog things. I don't generally participate. This one I got interested in because it was her essay was really high quality. It was a really good essay, and the responses that came were interesting, and I'll get into that in a second. But one of the themes that came up in the responses was that, well, why are we criticizing? Because she was criticizing welfare reform, And people were saying, why are we criticizing other animal people? Because, you know, it's just squabbling. And I would suggest to you, based on what I've said to you in the past several minutes, mm-hmm. it's not just a matter of squabbling. It's fundamental differences. I mean, squabbling is, you and I are, you know, spending the afternoon with each other, and, you know, you want to go to the beach and I want to go to a movie. And so we argue about it and we squabble.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not animal welfare reform is the correct response to the suffering and death of 53 billion animals annually, not including fish, or whether or not we should be taking a different approach, that's not a matter of squabbling. That's fundamental. You know, whether or not animals have rights is or not is a involves some sort of fundamental issues, not just a matter of squabbling. But some of the folks who have been commenting have been saying, hey, look, why are we squabbling when the real evil people are the factory farmers and the vivisectors and the furriers and those people? And the answer is no, those aren't the problem. Those people aren't the problem. I obviously don't agree that they should be doing what they're doing, but the problem is not the farmers, not the vivisectors, not the furriers, but those of us who demand the products that these people provide. They are capitalists. They would not be doing what they're doing. I mean, these agribusiness companies, these are big mega corporations. They're just looking to make the best return they can make. If we stopped demanding animal products, they would put their money into something else. And you know, whatever animal use you're talking about, it's driven by demand. You know, so I find it very interesting when the welfare people say, let's go after the exploiters. Well, who are the exploiters? The exploiters are those of us who are demanding animal products. The problem is nobody wants to acknowledge that, because most of the people who are contributing to these organizations are people who consume animal products. You know, there are people who, you know, some of them may be vegetarians, but, you know, they just can't, you know, they just like their ice cream and their cheese pizza or their milk so much, they simply can't give it up, or they can't give up their leather. They can't, you know, they're willing to support the suffering and death and torture of all of these animals because they like the taste of cheese pizza. So, you know, I mean, in my judgment, those people are the exploiters. Those people are the people we should be trying to persuade and trying to talk to. But those people are also donating the money to these large organizations. So who wants to upset them? So let's make evildoers out of, you know, let's turn the, you know, the factory farmer into the monster. But I wanted to make a, you know, which I think is crazy. But I wanted to make a couple of other comments about, you know, I really think people should go to that blog, My Face is on Fire. Is that the right name of it? My Face is on Fire?
Yes, that's you can be taken directly to it by Googling My Face is on Fire, but it's also myfaceisonfire.blogspot.com, and there's dashes in between each word, so my dash face dash etc. My Face is on Fire.
Yeah, it's a you know, she normally has I mean, her stuff is high quality as a general matter, but this particular essay I thought was really good, but you know, the people should go there and look at this exchange, because I think it's really interesting. She writes a really good, responsible, coherent, professional essay, making she makes arguments. She's not expressing her opinion. She's making arguments. She's saying, look, I disagree with the welfare reform, and here are the reasons why. Let me give you, you know, let me tell you the reasons why I think that there's a problem. And she gives you the reasons. And then what happens? People write and say, you're bashing the welfarists. You're vilifying the welfarists. You don't care about animal suffering. It becomes, you know, there's no substantive engagement with the arguments. It's simply name-calling. It's simply cultish recitation, mantra-like cultish repetition of, you know, you're bashing the welfarists. You're vilifying the welfarists. You're a purist. You're an elitist. You don't care about animals. There's no substantive engagement with her ideas. And what's very, very interesting is, because a number of us, because I participated in this as well, said, look, why don't you all stop whining about things and engage the substantive ideas that are being expressed here? Because that's really what we should be doing. If we care about these issues, we should be expressing our we should be debating and discussing them. And we don't debate and discuss them. As a matter of fact, it's almost impossible to get these people to debate and discuss the issue.
That's an interesting thing I've noticed, actually, because, you know, usually when you have, for instance, political issues, you know, abortion against pro-life, pro-choice, and that sort of thing, very easily you have two people or two parties who are willing to debate this. And like you've noticed, with animal rights, the abolitionist approach and animal welfare, I was surprised that Peter Singer himself, absolutely. I mean, I met him. I asked him. I said, would you debate someone like Gary Francione? And he said, no, we shouldn't infight.
Well, you see that's interesting because, you know, I've known Peter for many years. And again, I'm not making a moral judgment about Peter.
Right.
I disagree with him very strongly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure he believes sincerely what he says. But I just think he's wrong. Mm-hmm. And a number of people. Not just you. As a matter of fact, there was a professor at a college in New York who tried to set up a debate. Who invited Singer to debate, and Singer said no. There have been a number of people. There was a it's Bob Linden. Is it Go Vegan Radio
right,
or
right.
whatever? Yeah. He tried to set up a debate between me and Wayne Pacelle about Proposition 2 in California. Now, I've known Wayne for, you know, a long time. I've known Wayne since he was working for Fund for Animals 1.5 million ago. And, you know, again, I'm not making a moral judgment about Wayne. I actually like Wayne. I just disagree with him. And Bob tried to set up an interview with between me and Wayne. And Wayne at first accepted, and then he declined to do it. And when Peter's response to you, I think, is sort of interesting, when he said we shouldn't be infighting. It's not a matter of infighting. Peter and I have fundamentally different views about the way it's not a question that he and I are on the same side. And so we shouldn't be publicly arguing about it. He and I are not on the same side. To give you an analogy, let's take a practice, because, you know, the argument we always get, Adam, is, well, you know, people are going to continue to exploit animals no matter what, and so, you know, it's just going to keep on going on, so we've got to be practical. Okay, well, let me tell you something else. Another practice that's going to keep on, that's pervasive, goes on every day 1.5 million times, has forever and will forever, is rape. It is a serious problem. It has always been a serious problem. It will always be a serious – as long as the society,
sure.
as long as it's a patriarchal society, rape is going to be a problem. And so, you know, rape is a reality. For a lot of women, it is a horrible reality, and it inflicts an enormous amount of physical and emotional harm. Now, let's assume – you know, now, I assume you agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, fine. Now, let's assume – we have two responses to that. We can say, okay, well, you know what? Rape's a reality. It's going to keep on going on. So let's have a humane rape movement where what we try to do is, you know, we recognize that there are different sorts of rape. It's all battery, but there are certain sorts of battery. Some are, you know, some sorts of battering are worse than other
sure,
sorts
sure.
of battery. So why don't we have a campaign in which we say that we're going to have humane rape, and we're going to encourage everybody, if you're going to rape, then don't beat your victim before or after the rape, and try to do it as gently as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we going to have an approach that says we shouldn't have any rape whatsoever? Now, I see those. I don't see a disagreement between those two approaches or about those two approaches as a matter of infighting. I see them as fundamentally different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and so therefore, I think that. Peter is just wrong to say that we shouldn't have infighting, because it's not a matter of infighting. It's a question of fundamental disagreement. You know, I mean, one thing that I one of the issues that came up on that blog essay discussion that I was talking about was this response that, well, you know, if you oppose animal welfare reform, you must be, you know, you're don't you care about animal suffering? Well, you know, let me give you an analogy, and I don't think it's a far-fetched analogy. Indeed, I think it's dead on point. Let's assume that we're torturing somebody by tying the person in a chair and delivering electric shocks to that, very painful electric shocks to that person. Now, let's assume you say to me, well, would it be better if that person was sitting on a hard chair or on a soft padded chair? Well, I guess it would be better if you're going to be tortured with electric shocks. It would be marginally better if you were sitting in a chair with with padding. So what? But I mean, but that's what we're talking about with these animal welfare reforms. I mean, you know, well, if you don't care, you know, if you're not in favor of cage-free eggs, then you're in favor of animal suffering. And the answer is, let me tell you something. There is no difference, no significant difference between battery cage eggs and cage-free eggs, except cage-free eggs consist of one large cage. I mean, the animals are still crammed into an incredibly insane small amount of space. They're all still pecking at each other, which is why they have to be debeaked. Okay. They're all urinating on each other, defecating on each other. You know, they all are going to end. They're all being forced to, you know, they're using forced molting and things like that. And they're all going to end up in the same slaughterhouse anyway.
Okay, now that's interesting. So, that goes against what we tend to think when we look at the labels of these cage-free eggs, and it shows this big sunny barn, you know, fresh red paint on it. I think we tend to think that there's just a lot of room, they're moving around, but like you're saying, in fact, if you go to the Peaceful Prairie Sanctuary page, there's quite a bit of material, both in video and images, of what you're talking about with these birds. I wanted to put that out there because I don't think a lot of people are even aware of that.
Absolutely, Adam, and I'm glad you mentioned Peaceful Prairie, because actually, it's actually worse, because the stuff that Peaceful Prairie has, I have to look at it again, but my recollection is the videos they have are of free-range eggs, which is actually a step above cage-free, because cage-free, I believe that the stuff that Michelle and Chris have up there are free-range. I may be wrong about that, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but my recollection is that it's free range. And you see, cage free is they don't have to have any access to the outdoors. With free range, they're supposed to have some access to outdoor, now, which means basically you can have a huge barn which has got a small outside space where eight birds can sort of go out for a few seconds and then they rotate through and then eight more birds go out. So it doesn't require anything particular. You know, it just requires that they have some access to the outdoors. And the animals that Michelle and Chris have on the videos that they have, I believe, came from a free-range farm. I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. And but in any event, the bottom line is that all of this stuff is nonsense. You know, it goes back to this concept. You know, we all want to feel better. You know, we don't want to give up our eggs. We don't want to give up our ice cream. We don't want to give up our cheese pizza. We don't want to give up this. We don't want to give up that. So what we're going to do is we're going to give money to these organizations, and they're going to sell us these, you know, these indulgences, and they're going to make us feel better about exploiting animals. But that's really all that's going on. I mean, that's really all that is going on.
That concludes part one of my interview with Professor Gary Francione. I'll have the next parts up at vegan.fm and Gary's site, abolitionistapproach.com. Thanks for listening.